Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along today. It's an unusual lunchtime meeting, but it was the only time we could find to fit in Aaron Zellan today, and I'll introduce him briefly. Our speaker, Mr. Zellan, studied at Indiana and Brandeis Universities in the United States, currently doing his PhD at King's College, London. He's written for most of the major publications in the United States, and his most recent paper, which was published by the Washington Institute, is on Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, the conflict between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And Aaron Zellan's official position is fellow at the Washington Institute in the US, and he's visiting Australia per courtesy of the Australia-Israel Jewish Affairs Council. We're very grateful to them for providing our speaker today, who is going to talk on the topic of foreign fighters in Syria and Iraq. Mr. Zellan, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for the introduction. Thanks for coming out during lunchtime. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about foreign fighters in Syria and Iraq. Before I get into some of the more recent events, I think it's always important to look back to see how we got to where we currently are related to this, what the motivations of these individuals are, to better understand how this might go and the trajectory it could potentially take going forward in the future. So just as background, I'm going to talk first about what's been going on in Syria and then what's been going on in Iraq. So the uprising in Syria started in March 2011, which eventually turned into a civil war in June, July 2011, when the Assad regime started killing his own citizens. This led to the creation of the Free Syrian Army. While at the time people didn't realize it, the jihadists actually started entering the conflict as well in July 2011. This is when Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, when they're still, you know, okay with one another, decided behind the scenes to send a cell of individuals from Iraq inside Syria to create what would later become, as we know, of Jabhat al-Nusra. Additionally, while it didn't become an agenda issue for many Western governments until 2013 or so, we started to see already in August 2011 the sign that foreign fighters were going over to Syria as well. One of the interesting things about Jabhat al-Nusra was that, unlike Al-Qaeda in Iraq last decade, they're actually pretty, you know, decent insofar as they weren't excessive in their violence. They were targeting the Assad regime's military and security apparatus. They're working with local rebel groups and weren't really focusing on killing civilians. So it seemed in many ways that they had learned the lessons of the failures of Iraq last decade. And when the U.S. actually designated them in December 2012, there was a major backlash from the mainstream rebels against it, where they're talking about how they should support Jabhat al-Nusra and not designate them, and that the true terrorists were actually the Assad regime. And this was the point where I personally realized that the U.S.'s policies related to Syria were already in trouble, even though you still see some people believing that you could build up this so-called moderate force inside of Syria to help fight the Islamic State. One of the things related to why Jabhat al-Nusra was so good was that this sent a message to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, being like, well, I should publicly announce what many people privately already knew, that Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State were one and the same. But in reality, this actually led to the split between the two groups, which caused sort of the rift between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State that we've seen over the last year and a half or so. Part of this is because Abu Muhammad al-Jawlani believed that some of the worst practices of the Iraq jihad last decade would then be put into Syria, and that all of the hard work that they had been doing, culling and working with the local population, would be ruined. And therefore, this led to them, killing each other, essentially. And while they tried to reconcile with each other in the background, this never actually ended up working out. So in February this year, Al-Qaeda put out an official statement pretty much disaffiliating itself with the Islamic State, and for the first time they kicked out an affiliate from them. In terms of Iraq, one of the things to remember is that you started to see a vacuum being filled by the Islamic State after the U.S. left in December 2011. This is because the Iraqi military and political establishment just didn't have the same level of skills or even capabilities as the U.S. military when they're in there. As a result, you saw the Islamic State starting to go in and building up its networks once again, as well as everything related to its criminal enterprise in Mosul, Nineveh province, and parts of Anbar. One of the things that they're able to do to sort of build themselves back up again was related to creating these new military campaigns where they target Iraqi security officials and people in the military. But in addition to this, they also targeted a number of people that were in the tribal awakening that the U.S. helped build up, and then with the surge were able to consolidate some of the gains from what they're doing militarily on the ground against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Because of this, they started to assassinate a number of these top leaders, but on the side then reached out to a number of the clans within the tribes that were smaller to co-opt them. And therefore, the Islamic State was attempting to primarily divide and conquer a lot of the tribes, because they're worried that if they're able to return back to the same prominence again, that there would be a repeat of the tribal awakening, and therefore they would be pushed out of territory once again. But in fact, they're getting ahead of the curve and sort of trying to deter any of this happening. And it's actually been successful in many ways, because as we see now in the current military campaign, the U.S. is trying to once again build up some of the assets that they've used last decade in the fight against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But now the context is different. For one, many of the tribal figures feel that they got burned by the United States. Because after the U.S. left, they were promised that they would be integrated into the Iraqi political system, as well as many of the tribal figures being put into the security and military forces. But in fact, the Maliki government continued to be sectarian in the way it operated, and therefore this didn't really happen, which ended up leading to a number of protest movements by the Iraqi Sunnis against the Maliki regime in around December 2012, and they continue these protests over time. As a result of this, this made Maliki and some of the people on his side nervous, because they feared that the Sunnis would once again rise up and therefore Saddam Hussein era people would get back into power, and they never wanted that to happen to the Shia again. But Maliki miscalculated in December 2013 by destroying one of the protest camps in Ramadi. This led a number of the Sunni figures and tribal figures to believe that they no longer could try and get what they wanted from the government just through nonviolent protests, which led to sort of the recreation of a number of brigades. We saw the rise of the Naqshbandis, a bunch of ex-Ba'athist officials. We saw the mainstream Islamists get back into the fold of fighting again, Ansar al-Islam, Jaish al-Mujahideen, Jaish al-Islam. And therefore, this is what led to the recreation or sort of the rebirth of a larger scale insurgency that we hadn't really seen in a few years inside of Iraq. Of course, the Islamic State then piggybacked off of this and went about, you know, working with these actors, even if they had their own aims at the end of the day. This led to the fall of Fallujah and parts of Ramadi in February 2014. And then, as we all know, more recently, you know, the rise of more Western involvement as a result of the takeover of Mosul in June this year. So this sort of sets the stage for how we got to here. So related to the foreign fighters itself, this phenomenon has been around since the early 1980s, when you started to see a number of Arabs go to Afghanistan when the Soviets had invaded the country. At that time, the Afghan jihad, or the anti-Soviet jihad as some people call it, sort of was the biggest foreign fighter mobilization that we've seen in the contemporary era since this phenomenon really started. We saw about 5,000 individuals going over the years, and we really didn't see anything that large since then. Last decade in Iraq, we saw about 4,000 individuals. But the thing to remember about this is that the time period for this was a lot longer. So you saw 5,000 individuals go over a 13-year period in Afghanistan. We saw about 4,000 people go in about a 5 to 6 year period in Iraq. Where what we're seeing in Syria now is in 3 years, we've seen more than 10,000 individuals actually going. It's completely unprecedented. And unlike the past, where the majority of the people represented were Arabs, there were some Westerners too, but it was mainly Arabs. We've seen, at least based off my own research, at least 90 nationalities that have been represented. And the thing to note about the figures you might see in the media, when they say 10, 12, 15,000, whatever it is, that's not necessarily how many people are currently there at the time. It's literally impossible to do a census of these guys, of course, while they're in the war zone. But it's how many people have gone to the conflict since the beginning of 2011. So some of them have died. I've been able to record at least 2,500 foreigners who have been killed. We've also seen people go back home and arrested. We've also seen other people return home and just go back to their regular life. And then others, they've gone on to other conflict zones inside of, you know, whether it's in the Sinai or Libya or even Yemen. There are even some cases of people going back to Afghanistan, Pakistan region. The biggest areas we've seen where people have come from are primarily from the Arab world. The biggest countries among that segment are from Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, and Libya. But the second largest regional bloc is from Western Europe, and it's completely unprecedented in terms of the number of individuals who have gone. And we've seen about, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 Europeans going, and the countries most represented are those from France, Britain, Netherlands, as well as Belgium. One of the things is that even though there's been a relatively steady flow of individuals who have gone to Syria over the last couple of years, there are sort of three key spikes that we've seen in terms of when people have gone and a large number have gone at a certain time. So the first one was when Jabhat al-Nusra announced itself officially in January 2012. This is when many individuals realized that, you know, there are jihadi elements on the ground, and therefore they felt there was a clear banner, as they like to say, where they could fight under this fighting force and could go there. Then the second second one was in May 2013. This is when Hezbollah announced itself officially inside of Syria, assisting the Assad regime. Of course, as we know previously, Hezbollah had also been doing some training and advising, so they've been involved in the conflict. But this is when they overtly mentioned that they had been actually fighting on the ground. This led to a huge mobilization as well as radicalization amongst the Sunni communities. For the first time in the contemporary era, we also saw a number of key mainstream Gulf sheikhs calling for jihad and saying that it was an individual duty for people to go over there and to fight on the side of the Sunnis against the Assad regime. We never saw this happening in Afghanistan in the 80s, Bosnia and Chechnya in the 90s, or Afghanistan and Iraq last decade. So this led to a huge mobilization and a huge spike in the number of people that started to go. And then the most recent spike we've seen is related to the announcement of the caliphate by the Islamic State, because one of the things that they've done since they announced it is that they're not just calling for people to go there to fight, but they're also calling for people to go there to be involved in their state-building project. So this allows the recruitment pitch to expand the pool of potential individuals to go, because not everybody wants to go there to fight. People have other skills, so they're calling for doctors, engineers. They're having people be involved in the administration of this state. And therefore, we've seen people going that you wouldn't have seen in the past, whether it's wives going who could be involved in educating younger children and, you know, sort of growing up these kids in the militant milieu. We also see people bringing their families, whether it's their little kids. And you also see a number of younger women involved in sort of being nurses and, you know, helping out in general in terms of trying to make sure that women within the society are following sort of the precepts of their interpretations of Sharia. So what are the main reasons we've seen this unprecedented mobilization of individuals? One of the key reasons is just the ease of travel. It's a really simple argument. It's quite easy to get to Syria, and the main hub is to go through Turkey. In the past, it's very difficult to get to Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, or Mali. And if you get plane tickets to those areas, it might look pretty dubious, and therefore you'd likely get on some type of watch list. Whereas Turkey, you know, is a huge tourist destination. Istanbul gets millions of people per year, and it's not necessarily a sign of somebody trying to go there for radicalism. Additionally, in terms of the Western European context, it's quite cheap to get to Turkey, and they have visa waiver programs between the countries in the EU. So it's only like $50 to $80 to get a plane ticket. Some people are even just driving straight across the border all the way down to the Syrian border. One of the things to note also is the legacy of the facilitation and logistics networks from the Iraq war last decade. So while Turkey now is currently the hub of this type of activity for what's going on in Syria and Iraq, last decade Syria played that role, and therefore they rejuvenated a number of these networks. Another aspect is social media. Social media, you know, in the past they'd primarily be on password-protected forums. Therefore, now they have a larger amount of people that they can... Can I have a second? I need some water.
Yep.
Sorry. You got a little dizzy.
Yes.
Yeah, so essentially they can target more people on social media networks now than in the past, whereas before they had only a limited amount of people that they can garner support from in these password-protected forums, because individuals had to know where to go on these forums, whereas they can target certain individuals in different languages on social media. Additionally, the emotional resonance of this conflict is really important. Some people are seeing, you know, the Assad regime being Alawites slaughtering a bunch of Sunni Muslim men and women, and therefore they felt that Westerners weren't really helping out on this, nor were Arab governments, and therefore they felt it was an individual duty upon themselves to really help out. One of the things also related to this was that British jihadis put this out, was the so-called five-star jihad, compared to, say, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, or Mali. Life in Syria isn't too bad, and many of the individuals involved could live in these nice villas. There's pools in the background. Additionally, there are some places that actually had video game rooms so they can play Xbox during the day and at night actually fight. So they go from the virtual to the real world. And they have easy access to the internet on their mobile phones. So they get this from a Turkish SIM card and therefore able to interact with people online. So it's a lot easier in many respects than living the life in the mountains of Afghanistan. Another part of one of the reasons why people are going is religious. So historically, one of the past caliphates in Islamic history, the Umayyads, is actually based in Damascus. So there is some level of resonance related to this. And then for those who know end times prophecies related to Islam, there's the whole part of the story plays out in the Levant, in Syria. And therefore, some people actually believe that what they're seeing now is the sign of the end times, which will lead to the Day of Judgment. And therefore, you know, they'll then go over to paradise if they're victorious, which they obviously believe that they will be. One of the things that's developed over the conflict with the larger role of Iran, Lebanese Hezbollah, Iraqi Shia militiamen on the side of the Assad regime, is that we see large-scale sectarian religious hatred boiling up, and therefore one of the things that has led some people, especially in Saudi Arabia, to go is the sectarian angle. And then one of the more recent motivations related to this is the so-called caliphate project. Many individuals want to be involved in the state-building project. They feel very much empowered by it. For the first time in their own lives, or even looking back a couple of hundred years, they feel that Muslims are doing things on their own. They're not relying on the West. They're not relying on these authoritarian Arab regimes, but they can do it on their own. And this has a lot of resonance for a lot of younger people, especially those that might have some identity issues inside of Western countries where, say, they don't necessarily feel fully Pakistani, nor do they feel fully British, but they know that they're a Muslim, so it provides them with that level of empowerment. And then one of the things to remember about sort of what we saw in the last large scale jihad in Afghanistan in the 1980s was that there was a legacy of foreign fighter groups that were created out of this, which led to a lot of mayhem when they returned home. So groups like Al-Qaeda, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, GIA in Algeria, the Moroccan Islamic Combatant Group, and a whole host of others. We've seen a number of groups sprouting up like this as well, beyond just your Jabhat al-Nusra's or your Islamic States. So there are a lot of questions about what happens to these groups if they decide to return home. One of the largest among these sort of more national jihadi groups that have propped up is Harkat Sham al-Islam. It's a Moroccan group. And one of the things that they say is that while they're definitely here to fight the Assad regime, when they go back home, their plan is to try and take out the monarchy inside of Morocco, and they're using Syria as a battleground and training ground for them to gain these new skills. So there are a lot of questions about what will happen when some of these individuals do return home, especially since we saw what came out of Afghanistan in the 80s in terms of the different types of low-level and high-level insurgencies, whether it was in Egypt, whether it was in Libya, whether it was in Algeria in the 1990s. So one of the things about this foreign fighter issue, too, is that, you know, many people are talking about this in a theoretical manner. What happens when they do come home and not what we've already seen? The reality is there already has been blowback. There already has been spillover. We've seen an attack in Brussels against the Jewish Museum earlier this year. More recently, we saw the attack in Canada against the Parliament. And we've seen a whole host of arrests as well. So it's not a theoretical issue. It's a reality. Now, the question is how will this manifest itself over the coming weeks, months, and years? Just because we still are very much in the early stages. And it's also important to note that there is sort of a difference between how Al-Qaeda views external operations and how the Islamic State does, which is one of the reasons why a lot of Western governments are actually more worried about Jabhat al-Nusra and Al-Qaeda's plans for external operations than necessarily the Islamic State's. Because Al-Qaeda's MO over the years, their first priority, the raison d'etre, has always been to do terrorist attacks against the West, to hopefully bring Western governments into an exhausting economic war, and then therefore the West won't have enough money to prop up the so-called apostate Arab regimes, and therefore once that money dries up, it's easier for them to take over. Whereas the Islamic State, their sort of legitimacy is based off of this so-called caliphate they have, the territorial control they have. While they don't necessarily have an issue with doing an external operation, their main priority is to continue to consolidate their control over the areas that they're ruling, but also to potentially expand. Because if they lose or their territory is contracted, it looks pretty silly if you just have a caliphate in name only. So that's one of the reasons I believe that Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, their main spokesman more recently, called for individuals to do attacks outside of the zone because they still would gain benefits from somebody who's outside of Iraq or Syria doing an attack just in terms of psychologically, but also in terms of narrative, even if they don't necessarily have to plan, direct, or fund it, because we still haven't seen evidence of a planned, directed, or funded Islamic State plot, just one where people have been inspired by the Islamic State to do something on their own. So one of the things going forward because of this, though, is, how do people respond to this? We've seen a lot of talk in many Western countries over the last few months, maybe even going back a year, about, you know, new CVE programs. This is talking about countering violent extremism. This is sort of the cachet term for how to deal with it on the local level in terms of community engagement between police or the government and the Muslim communities in terms of trying to bring religious leaders, social workers in so that people, you know, are aware of what's going on. And also making parents aware. In the case of France and Germany, they've actually opened up a hotline for parents to call in case they're worried about their sons or daughters going abroad. Since in many cases we've seen parents not know about their kids getting involved in these types of activities because they're in their bedrooms by themselves in their cell phones and they just don't even know what's going on. And then one day they end up leaving. So parents are an important asset in this as well. We've seen more cases of governments rescinding passports. Of course, Australia's been doing this for years, even before what's been going on in Syria and Iraq. But we're seeing other countries starting to develop these types of rules as well, whether it's the UK, Canada as well. Another issue is related to control orders. This is something that the British government does, essentially putting individuals under house arrest, because sometimes it's difficult to get large scales of data since many of these people are, you know, just talking to each other face to face, so they don't have full evidence. But you know that based off of a lot of social network analysis and who these people are talking to on a daily basis are connected to these networks. So they essentially put them under house arrest until they have more evidence related to this. Then in the U.S., you have sting operations related to dealing with this. That's one of the reasons why you really haven't seen a large-scale issue in the United States. And there's also a variety of other factors. One of the interesting things that the Danish have actually been doing is that they're starting to institute a rehabilitation program for individuals who come back to be reintegrated into society and sort of bringing them back into the fold, whether it's through the local imams, whether it's through social workers, so that they don't necessarily have the effects of the war. Because some people argue that, you know, many of these guys are getting PTSD while they're over there, and just the fact that, you know, war has an effect on young individuals. And then more recently, we've seen with the UK, they just put out a new law, or proposing it, how they're banning individuals from coming home for at least 2 years just because they worry about it. Though the thing to remember about banning individuals, or even taking away people's passports, that doesn't necessarily mean that's going to potentially stop a terrorist attack. Because then if you do ban these individuals or, you know, take away their passports, they could then, instead of going over there, decide to do a terrorist attack at home. And we've seen a number of cases of this, most recently in Canada, of course. So there are a number of things that are being done. Obviously, there's no silver bullet per se. If this message of the Islamic State and other jihadis resonate with young people, you'll likely see people continuing to get involved in these things, unfortunately. But of course, it's the role of the government, civil society, and other people to get involved in trying to prevent anything worse from happening. And I think that, you know, we take for granted the work of intelligence and law enforcement in some ways. There have been about 400 to 500 plots against Western countries since 9/11. You don't hear about most of them, but it shows that, you know, they've been quite successful in dealing with this problem, and we should give them an applause more often than we like to give them, I think. So I'll just leave it there. I look forward to listening to your comments, some of your questions, and sorry about the water issue before. Thank you. Yeah.
And so we come to questions and discussion, and thanks again to the Australia, Israel, and Jewish Affairs Council for making it possible for us to get Aaron Zellan today. So first up, we've got till got about half an hour, no more than that. So we've got plenty of time. You've spoken, of course, about the Shia who were going off to fight the Alawite regime in Syria, or the Shia-dominated regime in Iraq. But what are the Shia doing? I mean, are there any Shia leaving Australia or Western Europe or North America and going off to fight for those regimes? Or are there Shia foreign fighters as well as Sunni foreign fighters?
That's a really good question. I think it's something that doesn't get enough attention related to what's going on in Syria, Iraq, and broadly this regional conflict. You just hear about Sunni foreign fighters, Sunni terrorists, but the fact is that there are a number of Shia radicals, Shia terrorists. Part of this is because of what Iran is doing. They're building up different proxy forces, providing money and recruitment for them. Obviously, you know about Lebanese Hezbollah's involvement, a number of the Iraqi Shia militias, but there are, in fact, Shia from other parts of the world that have been recruited by the IRGC to fight on behalf of the Assad regime or to help out inside of Iraq. So we've seen cases of Shia from Iran itself. We've seen Afghan Shia, Pakistani Shia, Shia from India. We've also seen some Shia from Scandinavia involved in this as well. There was actually a case of an American who tried to go over there, but he was arrested before he got onto a plane in the United States. An interesting thing to dovetail with this, besides just the issue of Shia foreign fighters getting involved in this, is that we're increasingly seeing Kurdish foreign fighters as well now helping out the PYD and the Peshmerga inside of both Iraqi and Syrian Kurdistan, which creates issues in of itself as well, just because some of these people are linking up with the PKK, which is still a designated terrorist organization in many Western countries. So there are complications related to both the Shia getting involved in these actions, as well as the Kurds, yet most of the focus is usually on the Sunnis. So there are foreign fighters on all sides of the conflict now, and it's going to create a major problem going forward in terms of what kind of instability that could potentially create to actors regionally, but also in terms of what that means when these individuals do come home.
Question here.
I have two questions. One is, what about Indonesia and Malaysia? In our vicinity, in our neighborhood, are there any foreign fighters going to fight? And the other question is really more of an analogous situation with the Second World War, when Churchill, and I'll be very fast. Churchill and
okay, so we'll just take one at a time. So the question is about Malaysia and Indonesia, and then we'll come back.
Yeah, we have seen foreign fighters from both Malaysia and Indonesia, as well as a number of other countries in this region, whether it's the Philippines, Thailand, people from Xinjiang and China. We've even seen like one or two cases of Japanese. And there's actually a video put out by the Islamic State featuring a number of Indonesians, maybe 20 or so, calling for people to be recruited and to come there. We've actually seen this one group in the Poso region of Indonesia pledge fealty to the Islamic State, as well as Abu Bakr al-Bashir, who's the leader of the old Jamal Islamiyah networks, who pledged bayat to the Islamic State as well. So there's clearly action going on in this region too, and it's not just the Arab world or Western Europe for that matter. And as we know with Bali, it can reach back all the way here.
So your second point?
And the second question is, as odious as Assad is, as I started to say, Churchill and Roosevelt in the Second World War clearly saw that they have to make a pact with the lesser evil, namely Stalin, to defeat Hitler. Why is there such a reluctance, as I said, not a friend of Assad? What is the reluctance of even potentially helping Assad?
Okay. So why is there a reluctance to help the Syrian regime?
Well, the main reason is that the Assad regime created this mess. He's the one that's been the key radicalizing factor. He's massacred 200,000 people. He's the reason why so many Sunnis have decided to go there. If you side with Assad in Iran, then you're just going to further fuel, put fire on this radicalization, as well as alienate our own allies in the Gulf states. And additionally, in terms of more practical matters, they haven't shown in the battlefield that they're that good anyways. I mean, without the help of Hezbollah in Iran, it's possible that the regime could have fallen already. They're having difficulty just holding on to their own territories. I don't have any confidence in them beyond the moral issues that they could actually retake the territory, and they just don't have any legitimacy at all. So there are a number of factors, in my opinion.
There's a question here. Yes?
You mentioned that they've got wives and girlfriends going over there to help with the Islamic State. In your estimation, are there large numbers of women who prepared to live under Sharia law?
There's a question about the women who are going to support the men, and are they prepared to live under Sharia law?
Yeah, I mean, some of these women are true believers in this ideology. They feel that this is how society should be run, this is God's will, God's law, and that this is the role that they take within the society. Whether we like it or not, or whether we agree with it or not, some people actually believe that. Though there have been some cases of women who have gone, who have regretted it, but the problem is that they're there now and it's very difficult to get back just because the Islamic State controls everything. So it's a, you know, it's a mistake that you have to live with your entire life if you do regret it.
Ida.
Could you comment on the reaction of some of the Western politicians who've mainly emphasized any links between these militant groups and Islam as a religion, considering that militant jihad is part of the religious lexicon and also probably important in the early spread of the empire and subsequent waves of extremism?
Okay, so you can repeat that. I mean, that's. I think
the question is mainly about the role of Islam and.
Politicians who say that IS is not Islamic. The question is, what about the religious influence on IS? I mean, is it Islamic or is it not Islamic?
I mean, I don't think that it's our role to decide what is Islamic or not. It's for Muslims to decide. That's not to say that the Islamic State represents most Muslims. They don't. They have a really narrow interpretation, and most Muslims outright have rejected them, even other jihadists themselves like Al-Qaeda. So it shows how far they are down the road. But to say that there's no sort of relation to Islam or their interpretations, that's just untrue and sort of sticks our head in the sand to say otherwise. But it's important to remember that they are pretty fringe in terms of their own interpretations and where they are within Islamic thought.
Thinking of religious wars going back centuries in Europe, they're pretty insidious things and they can take a long time. And from what you described, there's no sort of end to the number of young ones who, or even groups, who want to fuel the legions. So where do you see this going? Is it, is it going to affect Hamas in Gaza, and is it going to move into all sorts of areas of unrest in the Muslim world? Where do you see it going next?
Well, the question was about sort of the religious war between the Sunnis and Shia and whether it will spread to other parts of the region. We already see some areas where this could be happening. There have been some buildups of small proxy forces by Iran and Bahrain, and some of these individuals have familial ties to the Shia in eastern Saudi Arabia. And then you have the Iranians potentially trying to piggyback off of the success of the Houthis inside of Yemen, which have aggravated many of the tribal figures as well as AQAP inside of Yemen. And some people are saying that there could be now a potential civil war between these actors. I'm less concerned about Gaza or Palestine just because Palestinians are all Sunnis. There really aren't any Shia there. And also, the main fight is primarily between those who believe in sort of a Salafi interpretation of Islam on the Sunni side versus those who believe in a Khomeinist interpretation of Shiism on the other side, whereas a group like Hamas comes from more of an ideological perspective of the Muslim Brotherhood or the Ikhwan. So I'm unsure that they necessarily get caught up on it, especially since they themselves actually have relations with Iran. So that sort of goes against that. It's more between these radical Salafis and radical Khomeinists.
It's a question here. Yes?
I'm a little bit confused as what, in Syria, what is the sort of group that would be the idealist end winners? If you're saying on the one hand, from a Western point.
There isn't.
So the question is, if there's peace in Syria, what would a good peace be?
I think at this juncture there isn't one, to be honest. I think that there was a possibility a couple of years ago when there truly was a legitimate, you know, more nationalist type of entities that we could have worked with. But at this point, they're either completely weakened or defeated. The jihadists control most of northern Syria, whether it's the Islamic State in Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor, or Jabhat al-Nusra in Idlib. And then Jabhat al-Nusra has a presence in Qunaytir and Dara in the south as well. So honestly, I think that the politicians came to this way too late, and it's unfortunate. And I think Syria is a lot more difficult to try and solve than Iraq. I think we sort of know what we need to do in Iraq, but Syria is way past the point right now.
Fred?
Who's to blame for all of this? Is it the Americans that are backing Maliki and not forcing him to have a true United Iraqi government? Is that the, and what's the Israeli attitude?
Okay, the question is, are the Americans to blame for backing Maliki in Iraq, and what about Israel? Can we blame them too, I think?
No, the only Israel in the sense that a number of my Israeli friends see Iran as the main threat. And now you've got Iran versus Sunnis. Are they pleased?
All right, so is it the US? Is it Israel? Is it Iran? Who's responsible?
Well, I mean, I think that the U.S. likely has some role in it. We invaded Iraq in the first place, which has led to the snowball of events. But I do think that after the U.S. left, it did provide the conditions for there to be some type of reconciliation between the mainstream Sunni actors and the mainstream Shia actors. The problem was that Maliki wasn't willing to do that. Should the U.S. have said more to Maliki? It's definitely possible, but, you know, being thousands of miles away, what can the U.S. really do at that point, especially when President Obama wanted to be rid of the Iraq problem since he viewed it as, you know, a problem of the Bush administration. So there's that aspect to it as well. In terms of the Israelis, they're just keeping their heads low and making sure things don't affect their own territory. You know, everything's happening outside of their country. So as long as it's happening there, they don't want to get involved because they don't want to get drawn into it themselves. They'll deal with the issues if it does come to their border. But for now, they view Jabhat al-Nusra as not a threat on their border in Syria because they view Jabhat al-Nusra as focusing more on Damascus and the Assad regime. But they do worry that if the Islamic State is able to infiltrate southern Syria, that they'll then have more of a larger threat. They actually still view southern Lebanon with Hezbollah as a bigger issue, especially since Hezbollah is learning new military skills while they've been fighting inside of Syria. In the past, they've only been doing defensive guerrilla struggles, Whereas now, inside of Syria, they're learning offensive capabilities. They're learning how to work with other actors, whether it's the Syrian National Military, whether it's other Iraqi Shia militiamen, as well as logistics and how to work with an air force above them while they're on the ground fighting forces. So they definitely worry about the type of capabilities that Hezbollah now has as a result of this. Even if Hezbollah has taken some dents within their own society, militarily they're stronger than ever.
So, Eva?
How do you account for the fact that the Iraqi army, which I take it is essentially Shia, is so ineffective in fighting against Islamic State? The only people who seem to be putting up resistance are the Kurds.
I mean, it's difficult to say. It clearly shows an issue of training and discipline on behalf of the Iraqi military. You know, the strongest forces now from the Shia angle are actually the proxies that Iran has built up. And many of these proxies, whether it's Kitab Hezbollah, Asab al-Haq, the Badr organization, they've actually infiltrated the Iraqi military and using a lot of their hardware now because they seem to be more effective against the Islamic State, though there are still some questions about their effectiveness in of itself, since it's not as if they've taken back that much territory in the last couple of months. You know, there are questions about the Kurds. I think that they have done well in terms of holding their own territory in Iraqi Kurdistan, but part of that was just related to the U.S. helping out with the airstrikes, because before that, they actually did lose some territory. And then in Kobani, you know, while they're definitely hanging on to the city itself, their number of territory definitely has contracted as well. So there are major questions about the Kurds as well in terms of their capabilities, you know, to be any type of solution. And they're not going to help out in terms of being able to take back other territory since they'd be seen as, you know, occupying Arab land. So they're good insofar as, you know, maintaining control of their own territory. But in terms of expanding beyond that, it'll be difficult just because even secular nationalist Arabs, you know, would have issues with Kurds controlling their areas.
Question here.
As far as al-Baghdadi is concerned, we've heard that there was a targeted attack and he might have died, he might not have. Is there any news as to whether or not he's dead? And if so, what are the implications of that?
Question about al-Baghdadi. Baghdadi. Yeah.
Baghdadi.
Yeah, so Baghdadi's alive. He put out an audio message 2 days ago, and he was referencing events that have happened since, so he's not dead. But if, let's say, he was killed, there would likely be a meeting of the Leadership Council in the Islamic State to elect a new leader. So it's possible that it could happen down the road, though, because if these reports are true, it suggests that maybe the U.S. and the coalition has been able to start getting better intelligence on the ground. So we'll see what happens in the near future.
David.
I wanted to ask you, do you have a view on our government says we've stopped so many people going abroad. Are we not better off to let them go? Hope half of them are disposed of when they arrive and try and stop them, what's left, stop them coming back. Because if we leave them here frustrated, likely to behead us or blow us up in another place.
So the question is, should we let the foreign fighters fight overseas?
I mean, one of the issues with that is that many of them do come home, and there isn't, you know, there have been cases where people have been able to come home on fake passports or just slip through the cracks. So I don't think there's any, you know, 100% fail-safe in that regard. And they'd rather have them in the country here so that they can see what they're actually doing versus being abroad and a lot more difficult to follow in terms of intelligence and where they might go off to next.
Michael.
You raised some interesting questions about the Muslim diaspora, particularly in Europe, because you're talking about how many were coming from. And I acknowledge that you said that there's no census of the people fighting. But to what extent is there any knowledge of the extent to which they are, say, first generation born in Europe and Australia? And to what extent are they in, if you like, lower socioeconomic groups? In other words, what are the factors, apart from religious excitement, that has prompted such a large number, say, of Europeans?
I mean, I think that there isn't one profile of who's going. It's impossible to profile these guys. That's one of the challenges that many people in intelligence and law enforcement have. You know, you see people from lower socioeconomic statuses, but you also see people from very high socioeconomic statuses. Most of these individuals are university educated. You do see cases of people who have had criminal pasts, though. There are some cases of people who have converted as well, but in the European context, the majority of them are people that were born Muslim, though usually didn't necessarily grow up religious, but, you know, as they say, reverted to Islam when they got older. So, you know, there isn't necessarily one factor. I think a lot of it is related to just the social communalism that they feel, you know, this identity that they feel with people and empowerment in many respects. And, you know, it's difficult to say one way or another why somebody decides to go or not go, when some people could have exactly the same profiles and one person goes and one person doesn't.
But are most born in Europe?
Yeah, the vast majority of the Europeans are have been living there. I mean, they're second, third, fourth generation. You actually see a difference between Muslim communities that are first generation versus those that are second, third, fourth. And that's one of the reasons why you've seen lower figures in Portugal, Spain, and Italy, because most of those people are first generation. Whereas in other parts of Europe, they're mainly second, third, and fourth generation at this juncture.
So you're saying second, third, and fourth are more likely to be foreign fighters than first?
Yeah, in part because many of the first generation people are trying to leave their own, you know, authoritarian governments, want more opportunities, and are busy working because they're trying to get ahead, whereas, you know, some of their children, you know, are struggling with identity issues. As I alluded to earlier, they don't necessarily feel British or Pakistani. So this identity of just being a Muslim provides them an avenue to feel as if they have some type of identity themselves. And this is a feeling that many of them actually have had, as we've seen.
Yeah, this conflict has brought in a conflict in our own society over the word freedom, and no doubt the US as well. And it seems to me that we have given up certain freedoms and, to people like as agencies that use Google and what have you, and social media, Facebook and so on, to keep an eye on people. And then, on the other hand, the civil libertarians are saying it's all gone too far and there's people spying on us. Now, what's your perspective on this? Because it seems to me that if we throw away the freedom to look at what's happening on these social networks, then we're throwing away a lot of intelligence that could stop that bomb in marketplace.
Okay, I think...
I mean, I don't think anybody's calling for all these sites to be taken down. It's actually impossible. I've never heard anybody say that, really. And the thing is that they have been able to use a lot of this intelligence that they've gathered online to stop people. And for me personally, I don't feel like I've necessarily been affected by any of these larger measures on my day-to-day life. Maybe other people feel that way, but I certainly haven't. I still do the same thing that I've always done the last 12, 13 years or so. So, you know, the question is what they'll do in the future. I don't know, especially if they don't feel as if the current measures are enough. Then there could be questions about more civil liberties related to that. But so far, if they continue the same methods, which on some level have been successful, then, you know, I don't necessarily have an issue with it personally.
Question there.
All this fighting costs money. Is it only oil that finances these people and the fighting, or are there other sources?
Question is it oil that's financing IS, or is it other sources?
Well, for the Islamic State, they're actually a self-sufficient and self-running organization. They don't rely on private donors, really, compared to Al-Qaeda and their branches, which have historically relied on private donations from Gulf individuals. There's a study by Rand Corporation that suggests that only 5% of the Islamic State's budget's from that. The majority of it is from the land that they live on through a lot of criminal enterprise, whether it's running business rackets, extortion schemes, kidnaps for ransom. They're trafficking in antiquities. They're trafficking in oil that they have in their territory, as well as trafficking in weapons that they've been able to take in military battles that they've won. So there, and then in addition to that, they also have a whole taxation scheme. And depending on whether you're a Muslim or a Christian, you're taxed a different amount. But they have a number of revenue streams that aren't reliant on outside influence. And that's one of the reasons that they wanted to do that, because they didn't want to be influenced from the outside. And it's a lot more difficult to interdict, because in the past with Al-Qaeda, you could designate individuals, sanction them, and even get them arrested. Whereas this, you really need people on the ground to stop what's going on.
Question on the back? Yeah.
In the media, you don't get a sense that there are, in the Muslim communities in the Western world, sectarian tensions. There may be. They don't actually. But if there are returning fighters, are they likely to accentuate that, and that the problems could actually be internal within the Muslim communities rather than sovereign states?
The question about divisions within the Muslim communities and Western societies, is the current foreign fighter issue likely to have an impact and intensify that kind of conflict between Sunni and Shia living in the West?
We've actually seen cases of some small incidents in Germany between Sunnis and the Kurds. We've also seen some cases in some other parts of Europe between Sunni and Shia elements. It's definitely a possibility. And I think that it's something that should be looked at more into. But so far, I think that it hasn't really been an issue, just because a lot of it's more based off of what's going on in the region than necessarily what's going on here. Though if you do have foreign fighters returning that have more of a sectarian ideology and have issues with it, it could potentially lead to some problems, and something that I think politicians and people in law enforcement should look into more, just to make sure that they have an understanding and handle on it in case something does happen. And I think Australia is a case where it could be a problem, just because you do have a large number of both Sunni and Shia communities here.
Just a final question. People speak a lot about the coalition, the willing invasion of Iraq. But what about the Arab Spring? I mean, it's now about 4 years coming up that people thought that the Arab Spring would resolve a lot of these problems. To what extent has the Arab Spring contributed to these problems? Or is it not relevant to these problems? How do you look at the Arab Spring now?
Well, I think one of the things about the Arab Spring is that in many ways, over 30 to 40 years, many of the authoritarian regimes have hollowed out the civil society as well as the liberal movements within these societies. So even though some of the elements that were involved in the uprising definitely were not Islamists, they didn't have the same structures in place to potentially do politics. They're only good at doing protests. And therefore, on the other hand, the Islamists are far more organized because they're able to do things through the mosques. They have a whole social services sort of apparatus, and therefore are able to take advantage of it. And in the case of societies that have turned into civil wars or become violent, jihadism breeds off of the instability, and they're able to take advantage of it. And the longer these conflicts go on, the more that they can embed themselves and take advantage of sort of what's going on there. So I think that the Arab world in many respects is still in a revolutionary moment, and that we still haven't seen some of the worst of it in some cases, especially if there are issues in Algeria or Saudi Arabia related to the succession problems there. So this is just the beginning, in my opinion, unfortunately.
Many thanks. Take a seat. We're very grateful to Aaron Zelland for finding time to come and speak to the Sydney issue today at lunchtime. We don't do many talks at this time, but we thought it was an important topic, and our judgment was correct. Our speaker's given us 30 minutes analysis and then taken many, many questions across a whole range of issues on the particular issue of foreign fighters, but going beyond that to the culture around the foreign fighter problem, both overseas and within our own domestic society. So many thanks to Mr. Zelland for a fine presentation tonight. We'd love to have you back in the future, but for today, well done, and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.